I've never been in trouble in my life. I didn't even have a parking ticket. I didn't, you know what I mean? I was brought up like cops are the good guys.
I didn't know what was going to happen, but I do know that everything was stacked against me. Everything, like everything.
This isn't supposed to happen this way. I'm innocent. I know I'm innocent. I know I had nothing to do with this. How is this possible?
I grew up trusting systems. I grew up believing that every human being should do the right thing. And that's why, even though I knew I was dealing with corrupt people, I was not going to bribe anyone to get me out of prison. Because I wouldn't live with the fact that I bribed my way out of my wife's death.
I'm not innocent until proven guilty. I'm guilty until I prove my innocence. And that's absolutely what happened to me.
Our system, since I've been out 10 years, it's come a little ways, but it's still broken.
I totally lost trust in humanity after what happened to me.
This is Wrongful Conviction. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. That's me. And today I have an extraordinary person as my guest, a man named Rafael Madrigal. Rafael, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you.
And Rafael, you know, I often say, and I'm going to say to you, I'm happy you're here, but I'm sorry you're here, because there's absolutely no excuse for what happened to you. And as a member of, as an American and as a human, I apologize to you on behalf of everyone, because this story, it literally makes no sense whatsoever. And you know better than anyone. And I want to get into all those details, because your story has so many things that we see again and again, right? It has mistaken eyewitness identification. It has an incompetent defense attorney. It has an airtight alibi that anybody with any degree of sanity or education or knowledge of justice, nobody could have possibly convicted you based on those factors. But we're going to unravel all of that and find out how you got charged with first degree murder and how you got exonerated as we go along. But before we do that, let's go back like at a time machine to when you were a kid. Where did you grow up in California?
Yes, I did. I grew up in East Los Angeles.
So was it a difficult childhood or a happy family life? What can you paint a picture for us, to the audience? What was it like growing up?
Actually, it was a normal kid lifestyle. I mean, yeah, it was in a rough neighborhood, but I mean, my early teen years, I mean, it was just the regular neighborhood. Everybody was growing up and, you know, trying to find themselves. But later on, as we started getting older, then yeah, things started changing. You know, it was a rough neighborhood, a lot of gang violence around, and as the 90s started hitting, then, yeah, it started getting a little bit worse and worse and worse as time went along, you know, but as myself, I mean, I made the best of it. I graduated from high school. I got a job right after high school. College wasn't for me. I tried it for about a year, and I figured, you know what, college is not for me, so, you know, I decided, you know what, I think I'd rather work, and being that I was already going to be a father at 19, then, you know, I knew my responsibilities.
And both of those things you just mentioned are important parts of your story, right? The fact that you did become a father very young, and we know what this wrongful incarceration took from you. We're gonna discuss that. But also the fact that you did start working very young is an important thing as your story goes along, because of the fact that in your alibi, what made it so airtight, I mean, I was going to say bulletproof, you know, is the fact that you were a highly skilled person who was the only person that could operate the machinery at your job, which meant that, you know, there's no way you could have committed this crime 50 miles away when you were the only guy there that knew how to do what you were doing, and the whole factory would have shut down, right? So the whole operation would. So, but let's get into that by way of this crime, right? Because it was, I mean, this sounds like it was a hit, right? I mean, this was a shooting. Can you explain the crime itself? Obviously, you weren't there, but you're super familiar with it. It was a guy named Aguilera, right?
Correct. The victim, his name was Ricardo Aguilera. I mean, I ended up seeing him when he came and testified in court. But other than that, I've never had seen the gentleman. You know, it was a drive-by shooting. It was a gang war that was going on at the time in East Los Angeles. You know, I was 45 miles away from the incident, you know, nowhere near it. And I was still put in a situation where I lost 10 years of my life.
Well, how did, and you were sentenced to 25 to life, which is, I mean, unimaginable to think of how that must have, you know, just devastated you. But how did your name come up in the first place when you so obviously weren't there and you could prove it? And who was it that first, I know there were witnesses that identified you, but how did they even come to bring your name up? Did you ever find out how that happened?
Well, it all started off with the picture that the East Los Angeles Sheriff had of myself. The picture they took of me when I had just turned 16 years old. At the time of the crime, I was 25 already. So they used that picture to show the witnesses and the victim. And it all started with one of the witnesses stating that I resembled the shooter.
Okay, wait a minute. Now, first of all, let's go back. Let's go back for a second. So, Rafael, you were 16 when your picture was taken.
Correct.
Was it even appropriate for that picture to still even be in the books? Isn't that supposed to be sealed after you turn 18?
I'm not sure. I don't know how exactly that works or if there's any type of law that prohibits them from using almost a 10-year-old picture.
And what was the original, and sorry to interrupt you, but why was your picture in the book in the first place? What were you picked up for when, and I don't judge anything because I know where you grew up, there's a lot of people get picked up for a lot of things. They do the sweeps and everything else. And, you know, we've had people talk about how they were almost tricked into having their pictures taken and put into the mugshot book when they were just barely teenagers. And it's also sort of ridiculous to point out that they were using a 9-year-old. Can you imagine how much your appearance changes from 16 to 25? So why was your picture in the book in the first place?
And that picture, like I said, it was taken when I was 16. One day we were in front of my house and the gang unit ended up swooping by and everybody that was there inside my house, they pulled us all out and they took pictures of us and they went on their way. Never did I imagine in my life that that picture would come and haunt me almost 10 years later.
So you were literally doing nothing, standing around in front of your own house, and they took a picture that ended
exactly.
up turning your life completely upside down for the most random of reasons. And we'll get into that, too. The fact is that we know that there are ways to improve eyewitness identification procedures, including the fact that I'm guessing in your case, like in most cases, they were using 6 pictures on that page in the mugshot book. And, you know, decades of research have now proven scientifically that the human mind, if you give it that many options, will go towards somebody that sort of resembles a little bit. You'll start to make up things subconsciously that aren't real because you see all these different pictures. So by making the simple change of putting one picture per page, we know that the incidence of wrongful identifications go down by around 50%. So that's a change that we're trying to get made all over the country. And in any case, so I mean, this is an unbelievable thing. So you're now far away. You have no idea what's going on. Somewhere in a police station in East Los Angeles, these witnesses, one of them randomly picks your photo. And then what happens?
And then from there, I mean, the nightmare just started. From when the incident happened, I believe the incident took place on July 5th, 2000. And from there, after the incident, I believe they showed the pictures to the victim, to the witnesses. Sorry about that. To the witnesses. And 15 days later, after the incident, that's when I got picked up. I got picked up on July the 20th.
Yeah, July the 20th. So paint this picture for us, please. So you're July the 20th. Where were you?
July the 20th, I had just dropped off my wife at work. I was, because she went a little bit earlier than I did. I dropped her off at work. I was heading back home to get ready myself. And when I was driving into, I used to live in a cul-de-sac at the time. When I was driving in, I noticed that there was a bunch of a sheriff deputy patrol cars on the side of the street. And they were all putting on their gear. And the minute I see them, I said, oh, they're going to give somebody a rude awakening right now. Little did I know, they were going to my house.
And you, I read an article about you in the San Francisco Magazine. Where you were talking about how you were literally, I'm going to quote you, you said, I was literally living the American dream. And then I got everything pulled out from under my feet. You had 2 kids at this point. Your wife was pregnant. You had a good job, right? So life was looking pretty damn good, right?
Yeah. I mean, literally, we had just 30, it had been a year that we had bought our own house. So, I mean, I mean, that's what we were striving for, to buy our own house. We were tired of paying rent. So, I mean, we put our nest egg together, and everything that we had saved up for, we used it to buy this house. But little did we know that, I mean, this nightmare was going to start on July the 20th.
So you had two boys, 6 and 3, and a little girl on the way. And then you get picked up, taken in for questioning, I assume, right? And explain that process.
Well, the funny part is when I seen the sheriff patrol cars in the cul-de-sac, I came to the stop sign, and they had a picture of me, a blown up picture that they were going to my house with. So when I got to the stop sign, one of the deputies that had the picture, it just happens to be he was looking at the picture at the time. When I turned around and I looked at him, we locked eyes into each other, and he drew his weapon on me and he yelled at me, "Can I get off my van?" So yeah, sure enough, they got me off the van, and they said, the first thing they tell me, "Oh, they need to talk to you down at the station." So I tell them all of this here because they need to talk to me. And he said, "You know what, they'll explain to you a little bit more." Well, from there, they took me to the station. They put me in a van outside of the station, and they left me there for, I'd say, a good 4 hours. For what reason, I'm not sure. But I was in that van for 4 hours. 4 hours later, they put me inside a holding area. And I ask again, "Who needs to talk to me? What do we need to talk to me about?" And they said, "Oh, you know what, don't talk to you. That whole day went through. Nobody came to talk to me. Finally, there was two other inmates in a cell next to me when the detective involved in my case came to talk to them. And I asked them, "Hey, who's going to talk to me?" And he says, "You know what, wait your turn. I'll talk to you when I have time." So I told him, "Look, if you're not going to talk to me now, let me know. I'm going to bail out because I got to go to work." And his words to me were, "You know what, I'm going to give you some advice. Save your money because you're going
to
need it."
Who said that to you?
One of the lead detectives involved in my case.
Now you're there. First of all, I'm trying to process this whole idea of sitting for 4 hours in a van, not knowing what's going on, just left there. No, I mean, that's got to be a terrifying thing in and of itself. But okay, so now finally they come and talk to you and they tell you you're being charged with first degree murder.
Yeah, no, they didn't come talk to me. It wasn't until my arraignment, because I got arrested on Thursday morning. I got arraigned on Monday morning the following week. When I went into my arraignment, the same detective came and talked to me, and he asked me about my co-defendant. And he asked me, "When was the last time you seen him?"
Right, and this is an important point, because the co-defendant ultimately testifies that you were not involved, right?
No, he didn't testify to it. What it was that there was a tape recording from the county jail, because me and my co-defendant, I was pressuring him to tell me, "Hey, who did this? I know I have nothing to do with this. Somebody else is with you." And he just got, very upset because I was questioning him. And I told him, "Hey, you know what? I don't need to be here. I have nothing to do with this." So me and him got into a real big argument, and we ended up getting into a fight. 2 days later, his girlfriend came to visit him in the county jail. Well, when his girlfriend came to visit him, he had a black eye, and his girlfriend started questioning, "What's going on with you? What's going on with you inside of the jail?" So he told her, "You know what? I'm going to tell you the truth, everything that's going on. You know what? Ralph has nothing to do with this. He's asking around who was involved." And I told him it's none of his business. And he needs to keep his questions to himself. And he shouldn't have nobody else asking about this crime.
And that was Olivares that said that?
Yes, that was Olivares.
Uh-huh.
And originally, when that tape recording came to light, they had told my attorney that it was me in the tape recording confessing to the crime. So right before trial, they said, "Oh, we got a tape recording where he's confessing to the crime. We're going to use it." So when my attorney asked me about this recording, I said, "Look at Andrew." His name is Andrew Stein. I said, "Look at, from the day that I hired you, I told you I had nothing to do with this. I'm not going to change up on you. I still stand 100% that I have nothing to do with this." So he told me, "Okay, you know what? We're going to ask for an extension, and I'm going to listen to the recordings, and we'll come back in a month." So a month later, we come back, and I ask him what happened to the recordings. He goes, "Oh, you know what? Don't worry about it. There's nothing in them that can help you, and there's nothing in them that can hurt you."
None of that makes any sense. So first of all, let me backtrack. Were you out on bail, or were you locked up this whole time?
No, I was locked up this whole time because originally when I went for my arraignment, my bail was at $30,000. When I went to my arraignment, they raised my bail from $30,000 to $2 million.
$2 million. So they didn't want you going anywhere.
Correct.
And this attorney who we know... made a series of mistakes that are literally outrageous is the only word I can think of to explain the nature, the so many of them and so egregious that any law student would have been able to handle this case better than he did. Obviously, this was a court-appointed attorney, I'm assuming?
No, actually, he was a private attorney.
Wow. So this was a private attorney. I mean, was he... Do you have any theory as to what was wrong with him in terms of why was he so ill-suited for this job? Like, what... Was there something going on in his personal life? Was there some... Did you ever find out?
No, actually, you know what? When my family first hired him, I mean, he talked a real good story to my family, saying, you know what, I'm going to get home, and I'm going to prove his innocence. And, I mean, he just said everything that needed to be said. But as time was going by and postponement after postponement, it's like his whole demeanor just changed. Like, you know, like he just literally had given up on the case because he... Of the almost 3 years that I spent in the county jail fighting this case, one time he came to visit me. That was when my family hired him. After that, never again did he come to see me, ask me questions, nothing. It was just, I would only see him when we would go to court.
He came to see you one time in 3 years?
In 3 years.
Oh, my God. You know, this is so, it's so outrageous. And it's amazing, too. You know, I've just... finishing reading the amazing book by Anthony Ray Hinton called The Sun Does Shine, How I Found Life and Freedom on Death Row by Anthony Ray Hinton with Lara Love Hardin. And in it, he talks about Brian Stevenson, the legendary attorney who would visit him on death row over 15 years. Like, incredible, in a remote prison in Alabama. And here it is, like, one time in 3 years. I'm so angry at this whole thing. It's like, I can't process how that could even be. And then, in the meantime, he also made, like, mistakes that are unimaginable in terms of the idea that you had a tape recording. I'm just reflecting on this, right? You had a tape recording with the actual perpetrator saying that you, his co-defendant, wasn't there. And he couldn't even work with that. Like, he couldn't even... And he's telling you that the tape recording doesn't matter, and then he doesn't bring it up at court, among other things. Right? Because I'm not stopping there. I mean, the idea that during the trial he was unable to... He didn't call your coworker who would have testified and said that it was impossible for you to have committed this crime since, as I said earlier in the podcast... you were the only guy there that could operate the machinery. So, and we know that the machinery was operating, and we know that you were there, you were clocked in, it's just mind-boggling to me how this could have transpired the way it did, but and you lived it. So I want to get to this. So it finally comes to the trial. It took 3 years to get to trial?
Yeah, about 2.5 years.
Which is crazy in itself. And meanwhile, your right. kids are growing up without their father. Your wife is in the situation of trying to figure out how to make ends meet, which I know that ultimately she had to move out of the house, that your dream house, because, I mean, who can raise three kids and work a job? And, I mean, it's, you know... And in the meantime, she's left with the task of trying to explain to the kids. I'm sure they're asking, when's daddy coming home, right? I mean, it's so much. It's just so much. So you finally come to trial. And by the time you get to trial, now, I mean, you've got to be almost a basket case by this point.
I'm literally just, I mean, words wouldn't even be able to explain it. And just the worst part about it was that the doubt was there from the beginning, even for the prosecution. Keep in mind, I went through 4 district attorneys. It wasn't until the 4th one that decided to take it to trial. The first 3 came in. I mean, the first one, Mr. Dan Baker, which was the top gang prosecutor in Los Angeles County at the time. He came and he told my attorney at the time, you know what? I have an offer for him. My offer for him is 25 to life. That's the only thing I will offer him. You know, a year later, he leaves the case. They bring another prosecutor in from another another city, and he comes in the same way. You know what? There's no deals. There's no deals. Finally, when he's about maybe about 10 months into the case, he says, you know what? I might have a deal for you. We'll see how that turns out. The following month, he was off the case. They bought another gentleman from the city of Compton. He was on the case for a month. He let the case go. They finally brought in Mrs. Ramirez, Maria Ramirez, which is the one that finally took me to trial. And she's the one that finally convicted me. You know, and my thing was, yes.
Oh, Ralph, were you tried, if it's okay if I call you Ralph, were you tried together with Olivares or separately?
No, together.
But he didn't take the stand. And you had the tape recording, but the lawyer didn't bother to tell anybody about this tape recording where he was admitting that you weren't there.
Exactly. It's like these tape recordings, the prosecution is the one that brought them to light, but at the end, nobody used them. And when we got our appeal granted and we came to the federal courthouse and they asked Mr. Stein about the tape recordings, all he responded was, you know what, I think my secretary listened to them.
Wow, my secretary listened to them. Doesn't that say it all, right? that is what's so nuts to me, is that there are people in this justice system, I call it sometimes the injustice system, that are so cavalier about someone's life. Because in your case, it really was your life. I mean, 25 to life is a life sentence, let's face it. I mean, a 25 to life sentence, as a 25-year-old man, you're basically looking at spending the rest of your life behind bars. And this guy had his secretary listen to the recording. Okay, I'm just going to think about this for a second. So when you went to trial, by now, I'm assuming you had lost faith in your attorney. Did you consider firing him, hiring somebody else?
Well, I really didn't know much about the system of what you could and can do. It was my first time ever being in a position like this. Keep in mind, I have never been arrested before. I have never been in a trial before. So I was lost. You know, my only guidance was my attorney.
Right, and you want to have faith in him at this point. I'm assuming because you need to have faith in somebody or something, and he's your advocate, he's your champion. But when you went to trial, did you feel like did you feel like you were going to be exonerated? I mean, at this point, the system had already, you know, shown you its worst sides, so. But still, you knew you were innocent. So what was your, like, going in to the courtroom finally after all these years, or 2.5 years, 3 years, did you feel like you were going to be exonerated, or were you like, oh, you know, they've got me and that's going to be it?
No, actually, no. I I never let go of my faith in the truth. I was always under the impression, you know, once I go to trial, I'm going to be able to prove my innocence. I'm going to prove it. And the trial lasted 2 days. Deliberations lasted longer than the trial. The deliberations was almost 4 days. And they kept on coming back. The jury kept on coming back questioning my alibi. So the doubt was there from the beginning. It wasn't the doubt just to the jury. It was there from the beginning, even with the prosecution.
But here's another thing. As I was reading and rereading your story, I was thinking, you're sitting there next to your lawyer. He's not calling your alibi witness from the, I don't know what the guy's name was from the factory. Was it a factory or what was the place that you were working at? What was it called?
It was a manufacturing company, Proactive Packaging Interventions.
And what was the name of the guy who never was called, that should have been called, that could have actually, you know, absolutely, without any doubt, established your alibi as being factual?
That was my manager, Bob Howard.
Was he in the courtroom?
No, he was never in the courtroom. Actually, he got to the courtroom, and to my understanding, my attorney told him that he was not going to be called to testify. But he did show up.
Did you at any point say to your attorney, where is Bob Howard? Why isn't he here? Why aren't you calling him to the stand?
No, I mean, my head was just so lost when I kept on just hearing how the prosecution kept on just making me look like this animal. You know, and even when the victim himself got up on the stand and they asked him, do you see the person who shot you here today in this courtroom? the gentleman said, the person that shot me is not here. He wasn't lying. He was never lying. He was saying the truth. But what made that bad was that right after he got off the stand was that they put Detective Damuro on the stand and they asked him, Detective Damuro, why do you feel Mr. Aguilera is saying that the person who shot him is not here? So his comments were, oh, well, he feels he doesn't want to be labeled a snitch. He doesn't want to be labeled a rat. He doesn't want any repercussions. But it was never that. The gentleman was saying the truth. The person that shot him was not in the courtroom.
I'm trying to put myself inside the mind of the jury. Because inadequate is not a strong enough word, but even with such a incompetent, disinterested, even still, with that alone, you would think the jury would go, well, okay, I guess that's it, you know? And obviously they thought long and hard before they finally decided what they decided and sentenced you to this terrible term in prison. So that moment must have been the worst moment of your life. I can't imagine anything worse. When the jury came back in, did they look at you? Was your family in the courtroom? Was it hot? Was it cold? Do you remember? Can you paint a picture for us of what that was like?
And I remember it clearly like it was yesterday. It was almost day's end for the jury. And I was under the impression it was, I believe, a Friday. They were going to just bring us back on Monday. The bailiff called us in from the holding tank and says, you know what, I think they came back with the verdict. 3 o'clock, 3:30 in the afternoon. And I remember my palms were sweating so bad. And I don't know if it was hot in there or it was cold. I was nervous, you know. And the jury came back and just hearing those words, you know, we find the defendant guilty. It's like, if I had the world on my shoulders at the time, the world just came crashing down on me.
And you can't help thinking... Go ahead, Ralph.
I mean, it was just... Then turning around to see my family and just everybody breaking down crying because they knew the truth. I mean, nobody better than my family knew the truth. And them hearing the words guilty, it's like, it just took the air out of all of us.
And I can't help thinking that the fact that it was a weekend coming up and the jury didn't want to have to come back or be, I don't know if they were sequestered, but that probably played a role inside that room of them saying, you know what, maybe there was one or two holdouts and they finally said, you know what, this weekend, Monday, I got to go to work, whatever. And so for anybody who's listening, I always say, please, if you get called for jury duty, first of all, show up. I know it's annoying, it's difficult, it's an imposition on all of our lives. Show up, serve on a jury, pay attention, and remember that somebody like Raphael is hanging in the balance. His whole life is hanging in the balance when you're sitting there. And, you know, it's all of our duty to our fellow citizens, to our fellow human beings, that we give it, you know, all the attention that it deserves and that we remember that these mistakes happen as often as they do and you're living proof of it. So you're now convicted in a sense to 25 years to life, the worst thing that could possibly happen. You go to prison. I guess I want to get to the good part, right? The exoneration and what's happening now. But if you can tell us during you had been waiting almost 3 years for the trial and you were in for another almost seven in a maximum security prison.
Yes.
And was that as bad as everyone is imagining it to be? Was there any bright spot in that whole time you were there? What was the best and the worst aspect of that entire miserable time of 7 years? And again, this is in adding because you were in for almost 10, but the 7 years inside prison after you had been tried and convicted.
You know, I could honestly say the best point of those 10 years was coming across Eric Moltup, which was the attorney who originally contacted the California Interest Project. Mr. Moltop was referred to me by my state-appointed appeal attorney, Laura Schaefer. And when Laura Schaefer got my case originally after I got sentenced, you know, she was very honest with me. She told me the way it was, the system works. She says, look, you got to understand, we're state-appointed appeal attorneys. They don't pay us to do extra legwork. They just pay us to do push paperwork for you guys. You know, but after going through your case, you're not supposed to be here. And I told her, you know what? I know I'm not supposed to be here. And she went as far as telling me, but you know what? You're going to have to get a private attorney to be able to help you out. And she referred me to this gentleman, Eric Moltaup, out of Mill Valley, California. And this gentleman, from the beginning, when he got a hold of my case, he contacted me. And within a month and a half, I want to say, he wrote me a letter and he explained to me, he goes, look, kid, I read your case already. I don't know what you're doing in prison. You know, we need to get you home. And from there, he got the ball rolling. He started investigating. And the first thing that I told him when he came to visit me, I told him, Eric, one thing I need you to do is, because I had never listened to the tape recordings. I asked him, please listen to this tape recording. There's something there. It always stood in the back of my mind. There has to be something there. And he goes, okay, you know what? I'm going to listen to him. I kid you not, maybe within a month, he went back to the prison to see me again, and he asked me, is that you in the tape recordings? I said, look, Eric, I haven't listened to them. I don't know what's in them. So he brought a copy of the tape recordings, and he played it. And as soon as the first word came out of the tape recording, I told him, that's Francisco. I recognized his voice immediately. He says, are you sure? I said, look, I'm 100% sure that's Francisco Linares on the tape recordings. And that's what just got the ball rolling. We were able to admit the tape recordings back into evidence because originally the prosecution is the one that brought them out to light, but they were never used. So Eric goes, you know what? I got to get this back in there. And sure enough, that was one of the key things that the magistrate in the federal appeals court asked. Why were these tape recordings never used in his defense?
It's a damn good question. And it was newly discovered evidence at that point as well, which is great. So, okay, so let's fast forward now. What must have been, maybe other than the birth of your kids, or I don't know, but must have been the happiest day of your life, which is the day that you were back in court. How did you end up getting exonerated and released? And must have been like this million-pound weight is lifted off your shoulders now. So can you explain that?
Right. Well, the flip side was that we first had to file a motion for an evidentiary hearing. And we got that evidentiary hearing granted. So I was brought from prison back down to Orange County where the evidentiary hearing was going to take place. So during that evidentiary hearing, we were able to call my attorney who represented me. We put him on the stand, and we were able to bring Mr. Bob Howard and put him on the stand. So, I mean, all the pieces that were missing at the trial, we put them in front of the federal courthouse. And that's what was able to bring the light. So once we got Mr. Stein on the stand and he was able to just literally deny everything that he did and also put Mr. Howard on the stand and him admit, you know what, he was at work. I'm 100% positive he was at work. There's no way he could have been gone. You know, that's what took turn. This was in October. In June of 2009, my appeal was granted.
I mean, how did you feel? Were you freed from the courtroom? Explain the whole thing, because this is my favorite part of the show, right? The good part.
Right. Well, the next day, all that day, I didn't sleep all night. Literally, I slept not 1 hour of shut-eye. The next morning, I'm thinking, okay, they're going to call me early in the morning, and they're going to walk me out. 7 o'clock, nothing. 8 o'clock, nothing. Finally, one of the deputies came to my cell and said, you know what, get your stuff ready. I got to take you down to R&R, which is receiving and release. And he told me, oh, your attorney's supposed to be here to pick you up at 11 o'clock. But if he's not here, we have to let you go. That's the court order. So 11 o'clock came, and they walked me to the gate, and Mr. Eric Moltaup was there waiting for me. You know, it was an unexplainable relief. Happiness, I don't know if there was just a bunch of emotions going through me. You know, my dad just passed away 8 months earlier. So it was just a bunch of things going through my mind. You know, how was I going to get back into society? What was I going to do? You know, it's just a million things going through your mind. I get home and there's a bunch of cameras waiting for me, my family. I mean, literally it was the best day of my life. The only bad part about it that my dad wasn't there waiting for me.
I want to talk about something else that's really important in your case, and I know we don't have a lot of time left, but you were ultimately fully exonerated, conviction reversed, charges dropped, declared actually innocent. Is that right?
That's correct.
And so it's amazing, Raf, because I've been doing this work for 25, 26 years now, and I talk about it all the time. No matter where I am, I'm always talking about it. And I tell these stories about your case, about all these different cases that I know, because it drives me crazy. And the first question everybody asks me is, did the person, the man or woman, the exoneree, did they get compensated? It's the first thing everybody wants to know. Their eyes get real wide. They say, did the guy get, I hope they got, and I have to tell them, well, it's not what you think. And you're living proof of that, right? Because you have gone through almost like another trial. Well, it is another trial, just trying to get what's due for you. And in California, the compensation statute, and I'm working on getting it fixed, but it's so crazy. And can you explain that a little bit? Because most people think you get out, they send you a check. Hey, man, sorry, we messed up your life. Like, you know, let me give you a little way to get started here, you know, but that's not the way it is.
It's actually the total opposite. I mean, California, and it's sad to say that California, up until recently, their whole exoneration process was never there. I mean, the gate's open for you and, you know, there's no apology. There's no, like you said, a check waiting for you. There's nothing waiting for you. It's door opening and they just kick you out into the world. You know, I've been out, as a matter of fact, it's been 9 years. On Saturday, October the 6th, it's been my 9-year anniversary that I've been home.
Happy birthday. Happy anniversary.
Thank you. Up until now, I haven't seen any type of help from the state of California. I've been to hearings after hearings, and every time we go, it's like a new trial because you have these people on the board who are more into denying you, not the compensation, but the truth. Denying, they keep on denying the truth. You know, for what reason? I don't know. I don't know what holds them back from saying, you know what? A mistake was made here. We have to fix it. But up until this date, nobody in the state of California has said, you know what? We done these people wrong. We have to fix it. And I'm not the only one. There's several individual exonerees that are out here in California who haven't been compensated. They're in the same situation that I'm in. They've been fighting for their compensation for 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years.
No, I know. And I've read some of those stories and it's really horrible, including some that have ended up going back to prison just because they haven't been able to support themselves because they're facing the same thing that you're facing, which is they're coming out and having to tell their prospective employer that they have a conviction, even though it was overturned. And then they're either not getting hired or getting fired from the jobs that they, you know, that they should have. I think as a society, we have to open our hearts and minds and we have to open our companies. I talk to CEOs and other people in positions of power that run big companies about this all the time. I think there's a lot more openness to this now, to this concept that we need to give people a second chance, innocent or guilty, but particularly if you're innocent, to get back on their feet. And yet people like, Kenneth Foley is a classic example, right? Who was convicted of armed robbery in 95, sentenced to 25 years to life and exonerated in 2007 and then denied compensation and couldn't get a job and ultimately had PTSD and all these other things and ended up with a 15-year sentence for vehicular manslaughter because he was high on drugs or whatever it was. I mean, it's a tragedy on top of a tragedy. So it's amazing. The state is willing to pay all this money to keep you locked up, but they're not willing to pay anything to help you when you get out. It's so strange. What do you...
Correct.
And Rob, it's like, to me, it seems like the people sitting on that board, their job should be to figure out how to get you this money and how to help you manage it once you do get it. That would be the job of that board if I was running it. I would say, okay, let's make sure that not only are you going to get it, but you're going to know how to invest it. We're going to show you how to, you know what I mean? Because a lot of people in your situation coming out, well, you were actually a successful businessman already, but many people are not, and this is their first experience having a lump sum of money. So how would you fix this? Because it's crazy. You're literally having to prove your innocence again after a judge and a jury and a prosecutor, everybody else has decided you're innocent. How would you fix the system? What do you think it should be?
Well, I think the first thing off the top, it makes no sense to me for you to put a prosecutor on the compensation board. I mean, to me, that's the number one biggest mistake they could do. You know, a prosecutor to me will always be a prosecutor, no matter how you look at it. You know, he's never going to go against other prosecutors who probably convicted you and they know for a fact you were innocent. This is a situation that happened in my situation. You know, Mr. Mike Ramos, who is no longer on the board, but I mean, this gentleman here never once did he even take the time to say, you know what? I have an innocent individual here in front of me. What am I going to do to fix this problem? Instead, he was up on that seat being a prosecutor. He questioned me so much in regards to what took place 20 years ago instead of focusing on, you know what? We have an individual here who's innocent. That was never the case with him.
It's important to recognize that there are 31 states that have compensation statutes and 19 that have none. And even then, in some of those states, it's only you have to have a DNA proof or you have to have this or that. It's not a streamlined system like it should be. I think to me, once you're proven innocent and you're out, ironically, Texas has the best system. You get $80,000 per year for every year you win. You get an annuity. And sort of ironic that Texas, which most people would think would have one of the worst systems, actually has one of the best. I know why that is. It's thanks to Rodney Ellis, who was a state senator, who passed a bill that just really changed it, turned it upside down. And we need to do the same thing in California. And there are a lot of good people working on it. And I'm going to be helping to lead this charge to fix it for you and for everyone else like you, because it's disgusting, in my opinion, that you are now having to fight. And by the way, not only is it, as you said, it's the opposite of what it should be, because on top of everything else, you have to make time in your life, which you have enough obligations with three kids, work, struggling, everything else, to go and appear at all these different hearings and everything else. It's ridiculous. There should just be a check in the mailbox for you with your name on it that says, hey, good luck. Sorry this happened to you. You know, looking forward to seeing you succeed moving forward. Hope this helps. Something like that. You know what I mean? But man, it's really, I think it's so important that you're here and talking about this, because that problem has to get fixed, and it has to get fixed at the highest levels.
Right.
And I think I'm going to be keeping in touch with you if it's all right, because I'm going to call on you maybe to have some meetings with some, you know, people in positions of power who can make these changes. Because I believe if the people that make these decisions are made aware, which is why it's so important that you're here, they're going to want to fix this, because it just doesn't make any sense. But I just think people aren't really focused on it. So the more attention we can bring, the better it's going to be, obviously, for you and everybody else. So before we have to wrap up, I wanted to ask you one more question. There's actually two more questions. One question, how are your kids doing?
My kids are doing great. Thank God, you know, my oldest, Andrew, he's 24. He has about one more year, about a year and a half left at Long Beach State to complete his major. My second oldest, he just got two acceptance letters, one to Long Beach State and one to Cal State Fullerton also. So, I mean, family-wise, I cannot complain one bit, you know. I thank God that I came out, that my wife done such a great job with them in those 10 years. She, you know, guided them in the right direction. And now these kids are all grown up and they're leading a good life.
It's amazing. That's really an amazing testament to them. And like you said, to your wife, because to grow up in that situation without their dad, and to be able to, you know, take that adversity and turn it into, I only can call it triumph, because it sounds like they're knocking it out of the park. I mean, they're doing amazing, and that's and it's also a tribute to you. I mean, you obviously have had a tremendously positive influence on them. So, you know, I wish you and them all the best and everything that you deserve. Before we go, and I know you have to run, but I always like to end the show the same way, which is that I like to this is, I think, everyone's favorite part of the show, when I stop talking. And I just, first of all, want to thank you again for being here, taking time out of your schedule to share your story with the audience here on Wrongful Conviction. And now I'm going to turn it over to you just for any last thoughts that you want to share about anything. So the microphone is yours. And thank you again for being here.
Thank you. Well, I just want to take the time more than anything to thank my family and my wife, my kids, my mom, my dad, who is no longer with me, but I mean, all my thanks goes to him because he was one of the ones always in the front line with me fighting for this. I also want to thank Justin and all of the California Innocent Project. Eric Moltop. Eric Moltop was the key piece to exonerating me, to getting me home, you know. And last but not least, you know, to those prosecutors and detectives out there, you know, if you're hearing me, you know, take the time to investigate your cases. Don't just look for a conviction. It's not right putting people in prison for crimes that they're not commit. You're not only destroying their life, but you're destroying many lives behind their kids, their families. I mean, their parents. It just takes a toll on society itself. You know, I was one of the lucky ones who it only took 10 years to exonerate me. But there's gentlemen out there who were incarcerated for 20, 30 years. 30 years later, there's not a life out here for you. You know, everything has changed.
I think that's a great way to wrap up. I'm glad you brought up the California Innocence Project. I've had Justin on the podcast a couple of times, I think. And he is a huge source of inspiration for me and everybody in the movement. Of course, right now he's marching to Sacramento to deliver petitions for clemency on behalf of the California 12. And he really is just a great, great man. And I want to encourage everyone to go to CaliforniaInnocenceProject.org. That's CaliforniaInnocenceProject.org. Get involved, volunteer, donate, hold a fundraiser, do a bake sale, whatever your thing is. There's too many people in the same situation that Raphael was in, and we need to go get them out. And I will say to you now again, Raphael, I'll never stop fighting. There's a ton of good people who care about you and everyone else like you out there. So I know you got to get to work, so I'm not going to hold you up anymore. But thanks again. I'm looking forward to meeting you in California the next time. And
thank you.
And all my best to you and your family.
Likewise.
Don't forget to give us a fantastic review wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps. And I'm a proud donor to the Innocence Project, and I really hope you'll join me in supporting this very important cause and helping to prevent future wrongful convictions. Go to innocenceproject.org to learn how to donate and get involved. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kevin Wardis. The music in the show is by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction and on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast. Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.